Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening. This is the podcast that asks one big question in many ways. How can higher consciousness play a key role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? I've now conducted over 100 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for download. Today, I'm joined by Steve McIntosh, and we'll continue that discussion in a conversation entitled The Love of God and Non-Dual Samadhi, How Evolutionary Spirituality Integrates Our Highest Spiritual Experiences. I'll introduce Steve McIntosh, and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Steve McIntosh is an important integral philosopher and the author of three books, the just-released one, The Presence of the Infinite, as well as Evolution's Purpose and Integral Consciousness. In addition to his work in spiritual philosophy, Steve is also co-founder and president of the Integral Political Think Tank, the Institute for Cultural Evolution, which focuses on the cultural roots of America's challenges. Before he got involved with the Integral movement, he had several other successful careers, including being a world-class bicyclist, the founder of the consumer products company Now in Zen, being an attorney with one of America's largest firms, and as an executive with Celestial Seasonings Tea Company. He's an honors graduate of the University of Virginia Law School and the University of Southern California Business School. What I especially appreciate about Steve is his rare combination of virtues. He brings original philosophical insight, eloquence, passion, brilliance, and deep dedication to something greater, the same larger project that inspires my own work. That project is building the new integral evolutionary worldview, strengthening integral evolutionary culture, and helping it gain mainstream influence. He brings wonderful originality and creativity, both in his writings and in his work with the Institute for Cultural Evolution. Full disclosure, Steve has become a close friend during the last decade, in no small part because our conversations are so often invigorating, provocative, and full of original ideas. So welcome, Steve. Thanks so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I got to say, that was a lovely introduction, and I just want to say how proud I am of you in bringing forward this beautiful spiritual fruit of the Beyond Awakening series. It's really, really an awesome contribution to the culture.
Thanks so much, man. Well, congratulations on your new book. You've captured some luminous and fragrant distinctions that you've elaborated and that you shared. I had a chance to see the terrific presentation that I hosted in September at Bay Area Integral. So maybe you can begin this conversation by laying out some, you know, some terms of the discourse we want to have today and share this core distinction that we titled our conversation after, this dynamic relationship between the love of God and non-dual samadhi.
Sure. Well, what the book, The Presence of the Infinite, is specifically focused on is on the emergence of evolutionary spirituality or integral spirituality. I kind of use the terms evolutionary and integral as somewhat synonymous and interchangeable. As you and I know, and as many of the listeners to this series know, we're participating in the emergence of this integral or evolutionary perspective. It's kind of a new form of culture, or if it lives up to its potential, a new stage of human history. And just as this integral perspective is attempting to kind of achieve its time and its progress in history by pushing off against the limitations of the existing culture, both the mainstream establishment modernist culture and the countercultural postmodern culture, as we refer to it, you know, the kind of the green worldview that's achieved a lot and which is probably the most beautiful and evolved form of major culture that's yet to appear in human history. And yet, it is still countercultural after these many decades. We've been participating in it. So we want to include all of the important accomplishments of alternative or progressive culture, but we also want to push off against its limitations and provide a kind of emergence that can bring our society together at a higher level than it currently exists. And so this new stage of culture, this new historically significant worldview, will have many elements to it, you know, a new kind of politics, a new kind of psychology, a new approach to business, and many different elements of the integral worldview. But to me, that where this integral perspective shines the most lustrous light is in the realm of spirituality. In other words, integral or evolutionary spirituality is an emerging new kind. It's more inclusive and more transcendent than I think any other family of spiritual views that has previously appeared. So defining what integral spirituality is, what form the spirituality of this new stage of history will take, and how it can be distinguished from previous forms of spirituality is kind of the focus of the book. What I've yearned for throughout my life since I was 12 years old is the opportunity to participate in that kind of a spiritual renaissance, you know, an emergence of a kind of spirituality that can bring people together at a whole new level, while still retaining pluralism, obviously. And I've been working in the realm of what I call progressive spirituality. You know, this is the alternative spiritual milieu that includes the discovery of the wisdom of the East, you know, by people in the West, by the rediscovering of indigenous and earth-based spirituality. There's a wide diversity of views and paths within this category I'm calling progressive spirituality. And indeed, it sort of rescued spirituality from death at the hands of modernity, right, which was seeking to push away from previous expressions of religious or traditional spirituality. So progressive spirituality is something I've been participating in for the last, you know, since I was 12, since the 70s, and I've sort of been through the ups and downs of it. But in 1999, when I kind of dedicated myself to participating in the emergence of this integral perspective, I could see that one of our points of departure, one of the ways we could help make things more evolved, was by pushing off against the shortcomings of progressive spirituality, you know, as a cultural agreement structure, right? So evolutionary spirituality is attempting the tricky move, if you will, of transcending New Age and progressive spirituality, while also standing on its shoulders and including its important accomplishments that we've seen over the last 50 years of history in America and in other parts of the world. So defining what evolutionary spirituality is, according to this integral perspective, involves understanding how we can move beyond the shortcomings of progressive spirituality, its magical thinking, its sort of pseudoscience, its extreme relativism, which is a flip side of its positive pluralism, right? Like a thousand flowers can bloom within the cultural agreement of progressive spirituality, and that's an important, beautiful thing. Is we're the paths, the different paths that are welcome within this cultural structure are influencing each other, and we've made a lot of progress, but it still remains extremely countercultural, right? Progressive spirituality is not taken seriously by the media, by academia, by the educational establishment, I think for understandable reasons, but because I've been involved with it for 50 years, part of me is disappointed that it hasn't produced the kind of the spiritual renaissance that that was its promise, you know, that drew me into it. And that's because I think this spiritual renaissance that is on the horizon of history is really going to take form and grow out of this integral level. So this is kind of what we've been waiting for. We just have to sort of make it through the important phase of progressive spirituality so that we can now claim the important new truths of evolutionary spirituality. So as I argue in the book, one of the ways that evolutionary spirituality does this is by better harmonizing science and spirit on their own terms. You know, in other words, progressive spirituality attempts to bring in scientific insights like quantum theory. I mean, I remember in the 70s going to see Fritjof Capra's The Tao of Physics. It was extremely exciting to see how he was showing that the insights of the mystics, you know, from the great Eastern traditions overlapped in, you know, amazing ways with the discoveries of modern physics. But even though progressive spirituality has been attempting to harmonize science and spirit, Often it's sort of pseudo-scientific perspective, or it's cherry-picking of science, or it's making a mountain out of a molehill when it comes to a particular piece of science. The scientific establishment obviously rejects almost all the attempts of progressive spirituality to harmonize or appropriate science. And again, you know, these are dialectical tensions within history, and they're understandable. But evolutionary spirituality is able to go beyond progressive spirituality by harmonizing science and spirit because it's more philosophically sophisticated. It brings back the kind of the rational, the philosophical. You know, postmodern culture, green culture, was attempting to push, and is still attempting to push off against modernity, which is hyper-rational, right? So one of the ways that you transcend modernity is relaxing its analytical propensities. But now that we're postmodern, now that we're going beyond postmodernism itself, we can reclaim the rational and the analytical. We can bring back the truth to, you know, into the realm of the goodness and the beauty where it's previously been bracketed, and get more serious about taking science seriously on its own terms. And so one of the ways that evolutionary spirituality does this, brings in the truth, the powerful truth of science at a higher level and in a way that's more effectively integrated with spiritual teachings, is through what I call the spiritual teachings of evolution. That is, the scientific and historical story of our origins, you know, which has now only been really truly revealed in the last few decades, right? It's only since the 1960s that we've known that the universe was only 13.8 billion years ago, that time itself, you know, began in an instant, only three times older than the Earth itself. And this new story of our origins, you know, cosmological, biological, psychosocial, there's so much truth in this amazing new understanding of how the universe came to be that there's inevitably spiritual truth in there as well. And so evolutionary spirituality is able to get at that spiritual truth, as I call the spiritual teachings of evolution. And as it does this, as it brings in and begins to interpret our evolutionary story for its spiritual potential, what this does is it illuminates how we can transcend progressive spirituality, and I think eventually provide greater spiritual leadership, greater agreement potential, greater social solidarity, you know, for American culture, that while still retaining pluralism, can make an understanding of spirit by whatever name, the fact that the infinite is present in the finite, that spirit can be experienced, that it's not all in the head, you know, that it's not just all a kind of a mythic hangover from the pre-modern traditional stage, that actually this is our purpose in the universe, is to have spiritual experience and to gradually perfect ourselves, our culture, the world we live in. So the book goes into the teachings of evolution and the practice of perfecting the universe, of self, culture, and nature. It describes the abundant spiritual experience that could be found within the intrinsic values of the beautiful, the true, and the good. I think evolutionary spirituality could also be called beauty, truth, and goodness spirituality, because this is kind of its primary focus and indeed its major method for achieving spiritual growth, both within consciousness and within the larger culture. And as I analyze and describe and do my best to interpret the spiritual teachings available through evolution, it ultimately goes beyond this kind of spiritual experience of beauty, truth, and goodness and mysticism and, you know, psychedelic experience and all the different kinds of spiritual experience that I outline and describe from an integral perspective in my book. It broadens and deepens our understanding of the spiritual experience of ultimate reality itself. And that kind of brings us to the topic of our dialogue, but that's a kind of a very quick overview of the sort of the structure of the book.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, I want to just encourage you kind of to keep going and take it into this core polarity that you see as at the center of what distinguishes evolutionary spirituality from progressive spirituality.
Okay, sure. Well, one of the a major important new elements of integral philosophy that sort of recently gained traction among integralists that, you know, that's kind of a new addition is this idea of polarity theory, which comes from a variety of sources, and polarity theory is is the understanding that our world, our experience, when we attempt to make things better, when we attempt to grow, that the situation, whenever we're trying to create value, so to speak, that we often find that the act of value creation is bound up with interdependent polarities. And so we can see plenty of polarities in the world, you know, like good and bad is often a polarity that people think of first, and that could be understood as a sort of a positive-negative polarity. You know, so an example of that in concrete terms might be prosperity and poverty, right? I don't necessarily think that humanity will have to live with poverty for the rest of its existence. I think it's a problem we can eventually solve, right? Prosperity is good and poverty is bad. And when you have a polarity that's a positive-negative polarity, it really does present a problem to be solved because one end represents progress and the other represents the problem. But there's another very intriguing kind of polarity that we often encounter in our journey, and that's what's understood as a positive-positive polarity, where both sides are, in a sense, arranged in a polar way, that they challenge each other. They're not the same thing, that they're kind of pointing in different directions, but they're both creating value, right? So, you know, most obvious positive-positive polarity is male and female in the kind of the biological realm. But we can also see a positive-positive polarity in the form of freedom and order, or mercy and justice, right? Or science and spirit, or even beauty and truth. One of the ways that helps understand how each side creates value and how in a positive polarity the sides are interdependent and work together is by talking about the positive-positive polarity of competition and cooperation. Right? Within progressive culture, cooperation is almost always favored over competition, which is, again, understandable and evolutionarily appropriate because modernity is intensely competitive, right? Pathologically so in many cases. So as postmodernity attempts to push off against, you know, modernism and the mainstream, it naturally wants to move away from competition and embrace cooperation. But because competition and cooperation are ultimately part of an interdependent polarity, both sides need the other for maximized value creation. In other words, if we just embrace cooperation to the exclusion of individual excellence or originality or, you know, personal initiative, often you get stagnation or groupthink or bureaucracy, you know. But likewise, if you just focus on competition without an overarching moderating influence of cooperation, you can find that, you know, things become dog-eat-dog and you become arrested or stagnated in another way. But when the two sides are brought together, when one kind of rules the other, right, where individual excellence can thrive within an environment of cooperation, and cooperation becomes, you know, most effective when people are striving to do their best, we can begin to see how these interdependent polarities work together. Now, the cosmic element, the kind of spiritual element of polarity theory, is understanding how this universe of polarities that we encounter is, in a sense, a little self-similar or fractal refraction or reflection of the larger structure of the universe itself, which, as understood through the spiritual teachings of evolution, involves being and becoming, right? Infinite and finite, absolute and relative, you know, creator and creature. And this master structure of the universe that is 13.8 billion years ago, this finite realm that we live in, this world of time, began in an instant. But because we can experience that which is beyond time, it's not just some cosmic speculation about the infinite beginnings of the universe. Within what's known as panentheism, this kind of understanding that spirit is both infinite and transcendent, which is really a cornerstone of evolutionary spirituality as I understand it, this panentheistic appreciation of the experience of spirit itself reveals that the universe involves both pure being and becoming, because the being can be experienced within the becoming. But as I argue in the book, the becoming's not just an illusion. The becoming has spiritual value as well. That we don't want to collapse, you know, nature and history into pure being, or say that the universe of time and space is merely an illusion. You know, I think it's less real than the infinite pure being of the universe, but it does have spiritual reality. It does have a spiritual purpose, and so do we, as our role, you know, as citizens of the universe and ascenders in time. So the primordial, the prime polarity of being and becoming can be seen within every one. Every one of these polarities that I've been talking about retain the motif of part and whole. Like even male and female, which are entirely equal, still have this motif of part and whole in their character and even in their anatomy. Right, so it's a universal motif, and once we begin to see it and see that every one of these polarities, in a sense, is a kind of an opening for evolution, that the interdependent tension between the two poles of an interdependent polarity, that the tension energy itself is a kind of a seed of transcendence. You know, we can see that working through every one of these interdependent existential polarities is a kind of a dialectical through line, you know, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. The synthesis, the new growth, the new emergence is what every one of these polarities offers because they, in a sense, are the rungs of the ladder, you know, of evolution itself. They're kind of the little cogs, you know, on the cog railway of our ascent that we use to, you know, make progress step by step. So applying this understanding of existential polarities as engines of evolution, seeing how they're an essential part of the dialectical pattern of evolutionary growth, points to a very interesting kind of discovery or breakthrough, I think, that evolutionary spirituality is making, and that is to recognize that within time and space, that humans, that the experience of spirit itself is because it is a value-creating reality, that this also is configured according to an interdependent polarity. And you can see this interdependent polarity within the world body, historical and contemporary, within spiritual teachings. You can see it within spiritual practice. And again, you can see it within spiritual experience itself. So one of the ways that evolutionary spirituality can make progress, can help bring about, I think, a spiritual renaissance, is by increasing our hold on what spiritual experience is and how it works, by expanding the scope of you know, the practitioners of evolutionary spirituality can have spiritual experience more deeply, more widely, more abundantly, and use it more effectively in their work in the world because of the sort of this new revelation of spiritual experience that is one of the prime things that evolutionary spirituality delivers. But part of the way that we kind of can approach this expanded gift of spiritual experience is by seeing how spiritual experience itself is kind of can be understood and approached through what's known as a hermeneutic circle. Right, within philosophy, the idea of a hermeneutic circle is that how one concept kind of explains another in a circle, so that you kind of keep going around from one point of the circle to another, and it's you can deepen your hold on each element of the circle. So the hermeneutic circle that I describe in the book is the circle of spiritual teachings, spiritual practice, and spiritual experience. These three things are linked, right? Even the most non-doctrinal forms of spiritual practice are still relying on spiritual teachings to kind of frame the value of the practice and the goal of the experience the practice provides. So there's no getting away from spiritual teachings. And while spiritual experience can be had sometimes spontaneously without any kind of practice, for most of us, spiritual practice is the road to spiritual experience. So because evolutionary spirituality is bringing back philosophy, as I said, it's bringing back the power of truth to bear, allows us to expand and evolve and grow the spiritual teachings that we agree to within this agreement structure. Even again, there's still plurality, there's still a variety of paths, but spiritual teachings are improved and made more true. And this widens in the hermeneutic circle. This widens our the power of our practice, which then expands our hold on spiritual experience, which then improves our ability to interpret the spiritual teachings. So the three things in this hermeneutic circle, teachings, practices, and experiences, are working together in a dynamic system, and this is one of the ways that spiritual philosophy isn't just, you know, intellectual speculation or just, you know, cogitation. It leads directly to a greater spiritual experience that transcends, you know, the mental or intellectual realm. So, with all that said, I can add that the spiritual experience that is this polarity that evolutionary spirituality reveals more clearly than ever before can be understood in terms of attractor basins, so to speak. So the idea of an attractor basin is from, you know, chaos or complexity theory, and the idea is that if you think about, you know, a marble rolling in a ball, you know, the marble can kind of maybe go around in the ball like a roulette wheel, but it eventually finds its depth at the bottom of the bowl. And on within one pole of spiritual teachings, spiritual practice, and spiritual experience, we find the attractor basin of non-duality, which is a very deep, ancient, you know, extremely important kind of spiritual experience that's been had by saints and sages, east and west, down through the ages, right? It's the apogee of the experience of non-duality is known in much of the literature as samadhi, right, as we mentioned in our title to this dialogue. The samadhi experience, also sometimes called the unitive experience, is a hyper-lucid sort of, people describe it as the most important, the closest they've come to experiencing ultimate reality in a pure way. Subject and object become one, right? Things that people who've had a non-dual, an authentic samadhi experience are in remarkable agreement about how this experience is an experience of being one with everything, an experience of ultimate oneness, of oneness beyond, you know, not even one, or beyond one. I mean, the saints and sages from Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, you know, from Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, as well as non-dual mystics within the Abrahamic religions, like the Sufi mystics, or the Jewish Kabbalah mystics, or the Christian mystics. Mysticism as a spiritual path is often discloses this non-dual samadhi as a kind of the height or depth of this attractor basin. And the attractor basin of non-duality has practices to go with it. There's lots of different practices that can yield a non-dual experience. But I think meditation, witness meditation, is probably the most revered and most effective and most universally agreed upon by those who are on a non-dual path as a kind of the royal road to the enlightenment experience of samadhi, right? So the most sophisticated forms of progressive spirituality, and now into the evolutionary level, there's been an important refinement and a deepening of non-duality as a spiritual path. You know, Eckhart Tolle is probably the most popular proponent of this kind of non-dual hybrid of Buddhism and Hinduism and the other mystical paths. But Ken Wilber also advocates, you know, a non-dual spiritual path, which is kind of a hybrid of you know, Vajrayana and Vedanta. And so non-duality, it has something that's been claimed by progressive spirituality because it was sort of a path open for development. In other words, as counterculturalists in the 70s attempted to find spirituality, and many of them had been awakened to spirituality through psychedelic experience, and they knew that there was more to the universe than matter in motion, but they didn't want to find their spirituality in the traditional milieu. They didn't want to regress to a pre-modern, traditional kind of a Christian or what was perceived as a mythic spirituality that wasn't appropriate for their realization or their experience. And so they found the counterculturalists in the 70s and in the last 50 years have found spiritual truth and their spiritual paths primarily within forms of spirituality that have a different feel and flavor than the Western spirituality that's, you know, the heritage of Western civilization. And that led to this discovery of the wisdom of the East, and especially the forms of Eastern spirituality, which were distinct. So in other words, a huge accomplishment of progressive spirituality and you know, emerging into evolutionary spirituality was this sort of bringing and discovering and refining and expanding this non-dual attractor basin of spiritual experience, practice, and teachings. And so this has been a huge accomplishment, which you know, I applaud and appreciate. But as I've participated in this, as, you know, so many of my friends are not on a non-dual path, and I've, you know, lived with them and experienced their spirit and you know, dabbled with this path myself, I've also come to see how, in a sense, there's this polarity that one of the ways progressive spirituality has, you know, it's sort of natural to want to interpret all of spirituality through a non-dual lens, to kind of make it all fit within, you know, non-duality, as non-duality is the ultimate summit. And again, that's evolutionarily appropriate and understandable. But with evolutionary spirituality, we can begin to understand that every one of these stages, as, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, the evolutionary level, the integral level, will have a distinct kind of spirituality that goes with it. And we can also see that every one of the major stages of human history has its own kind of spirituality. For example, at the tribal level, animism as a spiritual path, you know, indigenous spirituality, even though, of course, it's got wide diversity, there's also something very similar. All the tribal cultures throughout the world have a kind of an identifiable form of animism as their spirituality. And one of the ways progressive spirituality has grown and come into its own is it's reached back into indigenous spirituality and kind of teased apart the very important accomplishments, the very important visions that have been lost, you know, to history, and rediscovered how, you know, the indigenous shamans knew things which we've forgotten, which we can rediscover, right? So this process begins with progressive spirituality, but at the evolutionary level, we can begin to now do the same thing in the sense of reclaiming the truths that have been lost, and those truths are found at the traditional level, right? Both modernism and postmodernism have been involved in the historical project of pushing off against the pathologies of religion, the pathologies of traditional spirituality. You know, it's political feudalism, it's myths, it's oppressiveness, it's patriarchy, it's hierarchy. All of those elements, all of those, so the sort of the evolutionary scaffolding or the pathologies of traditional spirituality, they're still evident in the world today, right? We're still, dealing with the pathologies of traditional spirituality. But at the integral level, we're now kind of two dialectical steps removed from the traditional, right? Modernity breaks the political grip, and postmodernity rediscovers spirituality in all the non-traditional ways that it can. And so at the evolutionary level, we can begin to see that there's something very important that's universal, that's perennial, that's everlasting, that was discovered and was at the heart of traditional spirituality, that now that we're far enough away from it, you know, historically and in terms of consciousness, we can take a fresh look at it, and we can do what the integral perspective can do more effectively than any other perspective, and that is we can tease apart the dignities from the disasters, right? We can see that closely woven together with the pathologies are universal truths that are, again, everlasting. And so one of the everlasting truths of traditional spirituality that evolutionary spirituality can now begin to reclaim and practice at a higher level, you know, and indeed, you know, plant the seeds of emergence that can bring about a spiritual renaissance is what I call the love of God. You know, for lack of a better way to describe this, there's an entire attractor basin that's not exactly the same thing as the non-dual attractor basin, right? It's got its own teachings, its own practices, and while there's certainly overlap and complementarity, there's other ways in which this attractor basin that is theistic, that involves recognizing a God that is transcendent, that is separate, that is, you know, even though God lives inside of us, according to traditional spiritual teachings, God also transcends. God isn't just in the realm of beings. God is being itself, the necessary being. And because we look at the universe of beings and see that the ultimate matter of fact, as Whitehead understood, was creativity, right? It's not atoms or space or time or quarks. It's creativity itself. And this creativity has a necessary source, right? It didn't just pop into existence by magic. But again, we have to tease apart the anthropocentric notions of God, the mythic notions of God, the God as a sort of a cosmic magician who kind of waves a wand and creates the universe. All of these notions that are inherited from traditional spirituality, we have to carefully prune those away so that we can rediscover at a higher level the loving heart of the universe, which takes the form of a God who is transcendent. And you know, this being of who is God is an experience which is can be deeply had, and it is, in a sense, complementary. It challenges non-duality, but also complements it. It supplements it. And now at the evolutionary level, we can practice both of these poles in a way. We can still, you know, for Buddhists, we still have loyalty to Buddhism, yet we can allow, if you picture the yin-yang symbol, you know, the yin-yang symbol is a classic expression of an interdependent polarity, right? Within the black wave, there's a white dot. Within the white wave, there's a black dot. So each side of this interdependent polarity contains the other in its essence, but yet they're not exactly the same thing, right? So allowing for non-duality to be fully what it is, while also allowing a theistic understanding of spiritual reality to be fully what it is. I mean, one of the things progressive spirituality does is try to kind of bring these together in a false way, to say that they're just different paths to the top of the same mountain, right? And that's commendable, but there's a deeper truth to be discovered there. They're not just the same thing. And you see a lot of confusion when there's a kind of this sort of this mushy attempt to try to get it all into one place. But if we understand polarities as engines of evolution, we know that it's like a magnet. You know, if you play with a magnet and try to find its center, it throws you to one side or another because there's a dynamic system there. And, you know, there's the two sides are have of a tension. And that same physics of magnetism is seen within these interdependent polarities. And so the magnetism of theism and non-duality are like two legs of our spiritual progress. So rather than try to make it all fit on the non-dual side or try to mush it up in a way that the magnetism is lost, evolutionary spirituality can begin to use these contrasting, complementary, but challenging forms of spirituality as an engine of evolution to bring about a spiritual renaissance, you know, as I argue in the book.
Well, thank you, Steve. That was a tour de force. You managed to get so much into this first, whatever it is, 35 minutes or so of our conversation. I had imagined we were going to summarize it more briefly, but I think you did a much richer job, and it was certainly worth the extra minutes to get this.
Well, thanks for letting me go on.
Well, it's a foundation for a richer conversation. You know, in my in our conversations about this dialogue, and in my announcement about it, I promised that we would not just hear what you'd already thought through and it expressed in your book, but that we'd engage a dialogue where we'd challenge ourselves to go into new territory.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the let me say that I love many aspects of how you frame all of this, the role of philosophy, the role of an evolutionary integral spirituality, breaking the cultural stuckness that prevents progressive spirituality from having mainstream impact, the nature of enduring polarities, and even the specifics of these two attractor basins of the love of God and non-dual unity experience. But I have a different experience in my own life. You know, mm-hmm. I have, from the beginning of my path, have seen the radical, transcendental, radiant consciousness itself as containing within it, like the yin-yang symbol, perhaps, the necessary transformation of the being, an actual psychophysical yoga in which the body-mind is activated and awakened into a current of love bliss that's actually lived as love in relationship. And in fact, my core teaching and my brand, when I first created a website after having made my move to do this as my life's work, I called it the Integral Heart, because Integral, as it was mostly known then, was surrounding Ken Wilber's work, which is grounded in non-duality, and yet this heart principle needed emphasis. And so in my own way, I was emphasizing the relationship of the two, but for me, the love of God followed naturally from non-dual awakening, and that a true non-duality, if it's truly, really non-dual, it not only recognizes the self of all, the consciousness at the core of everything, the onlyness of being as the radical truth of all things, it recognizes it in the form of what's happening. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily just treat what's happening as an illusion. It awakens into a sense of transparency of it, but then also aliveness in it. So it's expressed as incarnate, radical love, the awakening of wonder, lucidity, and radiance, but also of love, and love in relationship to the paradoxical identity of it all, or God, the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very rich subjective and subtle yoga and, you know, intersubjective practice and relational love and service and even social responsibility. So to me, I wonder if to some degree this can, you know, function. In some of your presentations, you've, you know, seemingly been pointing out the limitations of non-duality. And it seems to me that you may be describing the immature and imperfect expressions of progressive spiritual culture that embraces non-duality, which is like any, you know, community. It has its bell curve of development. Not everybody represents the fullness and truth and expressive summa of its possibilities. There are all kinds of immature relation, you know, expressions of the love of God and of non-dual samadhi. And it may be, in a way, your critique of the non-dual is a critique of an immature form of non-duality, that real profound non-duality blossoms by its nature into the fullness of the love of God, that there wasn't necessarily a deficiency in that non-dual tradition in its essence. It's just that it's most commonly expressed in immature ways, just as love of God is often expressed in immature ways. And that then it kind of functions a little bit as a straw man, that really if we recognize non-dual samadhi in its highest potentials, it contains within itself the seed of this polarity of love in action. And in the foundations of it, being and becoming, neither is ultimately able to be all of what it is except with its counterpart, that polarity is embedded in each pole, and that therefore there has always been the beginnings of this evolutionary spirituality and the dynamism of this polarity, even within non-dual spirituality. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that all human understanding of spirit, at least, you know, while we're alive on this planet, will be partial, will be immature. I mean, in other words, we're immature as a species, you know, as a culture. So the immaturity is kind of an inevitable condition, even at the evolutionary level. We'll still be relatively immature, I think, in terms of the heights of potential for human spirituality. But regarding this idea that the non-dual side can, you know, contain the whole and express the whole, I think that's true. I think both sides of this polarity, the theistic and the non-dual, can provide firm roots for the growth of its line into the evolutionary spiritual level, right? That is, a non-dual spirituality can transcend progressive spirituality just as theistic spirituality can and will. But you know, and you, Terry, in your practice, you're at the evolutionary level. You're already doing these things, you know, kind of spontaneously and naturally. And so I say in the book, I think it's important for people to appreciate that they can still continue to have loyalty to their path, right? If Buddhism is their identity, then there's a way to practice Buddhism and be loyal to the teachings of Buddhism at the evolutionary level, you know, even though you have to transcend the traditional exclusivity and you have to transcend postmodern relativism, but Buddhism as a historical line of world development in spirituality will indeed do that. But what the recognition of the polarity allows us to do is to have the other side more abundantly than we normally would if we were primarily within our path and we weren't metabolizing or practicing this truth about the interdependent polarity of world spiritual teaching, spiritual practice, and spiritual experience. So, for example, going back to the yin-yang symbol, right, within the black wave is the white dot, right? So within non-dual teachings is, you know, love and compassion can be found, and people can grow, you know, on that side of this polarity, as I'm describing it, in a way that that brings in the other side of the polarity through and in that white dot, you know, which can be found at the heart. But what I'm saying is that we can go beyond that. We can, as if we're non-dualists, we can appreciate theism more robustly, not just as the white dot in our side of the polarity, but as an entirely other side, the white wave, you know, that has the black dot within it. It's a gold mine of spiritual experience, spiritual truth, and spiritual energy. And we need to bring that energy online if we're going to bring about a spiritual renaissance, which we know is the potential for evolutionary spirituality. So let me be a little bit more specific. Within non-dual teaching, you know, even the most sophisticated forms of it, a huge concern is with overcoming the self, right? In other words, the self is usually conflated with ego. And especially if your orientation as a spiritual path is toward oneness, toward the fact that there's as you said, that you know, that being is one, and there's no otherness than being, within that path, within that milieu, there's a natural tendency to sort of look down on the self or eliminate the self or even just de-emphasize the self. And again, that's a very important job that side of the polarity has to do. But, you know, the religious scholar Houston Smith had a very deep insight, which I continue to use, and that is the opposite of a small truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a great truth is an equal and opposite great truth. So in practical terms, this means that that one great truth is that we're all one, that we're all the same being having, you know, a unique experience as our bodies, but ultimately we're all kind of, there is no separation between us. We are part of, you know, an unseparate part of the one being, which is everything. And that's true. But an equal and opposite truth is that we're all original, that we're individuals, agents of evolution, who can love and be loved as, you know, sons and daughters of a living God. That is, we you know, we're not just the drop that's cast back into the sea where our originality or our identity is eliminated. That originality is the source of a deep and wide and empowering form of spiritual experience, which, as I mentioned, is this experience of being loved by the creator of the universe, you know, who is, in a sense, the essence of our higher self. But unless we allow for that originality in our you know, our purview of what's spiritually true, it can be confusing or it can be disempowering because, you know, again, if we're just trying to transcend our ego and be cast like a drop back into the sea where we lose our identity, then we lose this ability to connect as a node of love. You know, love is, at its essence, irreducibly relational. It's a relationship. But if there's no separation, then this idea of love is ungrounded at best, or, you know, rendered into a slogan, you know, that's thrown around, you know, compassion, of course. But the idea of it, the relationality of it, is if the truth of that is not held as part of this kind of idea that we are original beings, that we have a sovereign free will and a role to play in perfecting the universe, those truths are grounded on a theistic side. And so metabolizing those truths, bringing those truths into our experience, living those truths, involves allowing for some of this theistic truth to enter more robustly into our spiritual paths, into our spiritual lives. And so that's what evolutionary spirituality offers, is the opportunity to work with, to bring back the theistic truth of a loving creator, a God that beholds with his or her gaze, beholds our cruelties and our betrayals, you know, our triumphs and our fears, who goes through life with us, inside of us, as the heart of who we are, who knows us and loves us as sons and daughters. You know, that's one of the primary teachings of theistic spirituality. And again, it's ungrounded at best or denied at worst within most forms of non-dual discourse, which again is not all wrong. Again, this is interdependent polarity. Both sides are true by turns. And so trying to eliminate the tension or the dynamism, making a still photo out of what is essentially a movie, you know, that it's moving back and forth, by recapturing, by discovering how these truths are dynamic, that they're not static, that they're not just propositions that we, you know, assent to, but that they're living engines of evolution that we can use to transport us, spiritual truth becomes alive in a way that it never has. And that's one of the ways that the spiritual philosophy of integral, the evolutionary perspective, really does bring alive our spirituality in ways that it's never been able to be enlivened before.
Well, that was beautifully articulated, Steve, and I resonated most always with what you were saying. But I do want to say something that kind of keeps our dialogue and the dynamism of our mutually complementary polarities alive for our next conversation, and then move on to another topic. So
okay.
What I'd like to say there is that for me, it was the radicality of the non-dual intuition both awakening me from my individuality that transformed my relationship to it and to will and to my whole, you know, the you might say the center having been shattered, my relationship to the center of my own experience was transformed, and that liberated me to love in a whole different way and to be in relationship in a whole different way. And so for me, it was almost, just as you said, let's not go to a mushy center. It was the radical brilliance of non-dual truth that liberated me into then what is for me, and just as you describe, another equally powerful truth, which is the living presence of God as love, and my open-hearted gratitude and desire to celebrate, praise, and serve that glorious, intimate relation. And so for me, the appreciation of this fundamental polarity resonates really, really highly. I just see it naturally growing out of the non-duality, and the nature of progressive spirituality isn't, for me, inherently deficient. It contains within itself the seeds for it to outgrow its limitations and become everything you're calling for.
Well, and it's doing so now in this very conversation. You know, I mean,
yeah, there we go.
Each side could be a platform, you know, for the transcendence, and each side can reclaim the other as the natural course of its growth.
Well, let me lean into something that I thought was really juicy in what you just said, which was this love for God and feeling God's love for you as divine father and mother, the sense of participating in life out of being in a loving divine family. And I really want to explore that experientially, like the experience of the spiritual experience you were talking about. You know, how does that feel for you, and how does that inform your existential sense of being right here and right now? I'd love to invite you to go into that.
Sure. Well, the way I experience the love of God is as a presence in my life. You know, the presence of God, especially in more heightened moments of my life, both when I'm holding my 9-year-old son, you know, in my arms, and I think about how much I love him. Just, you know, oh my God, he's so precious. He's such a gift to me that I get to be his father, and he's such a beautiful, you know, person to see him grow and to have the privilege of parenting him and going through life with him. That parental love that I feel in my heart for my sons, it's as if there's a sun shining behind me that's warming me, that the love in my heart is coming from a greater source of love, which loves us both. That just as I'm, you know, feeling that parental love for my son, I'm also feeling the parental love of the creator of the universe for me and my son together. So that's a very deep way in which, through parenting, through this spiritual practice and experience of parenting, that I've come to appreciate how that's really the highest experience that I've had in my life, is that kind of love. And that parental love that's a universal feature of creation, of being, becomes self-evident in a way, you know, through this practice. But also, you know, I feel the love of God in gratitude. Like when I'm in a, you know, I spend a lot of time in the wilderness and in beautiful settings. And so it's almost like, you know, surrounding myself in an extremely beautiful scene in nature is a spiritual practice in itself wherein I feel that gratitude. I feel that sense of that sort of being known and loved, and just the, as the beauty itself is a little taste of the transcendent. And because the beauty is connected to not just truth but also goodness. You know, goodness, the heart of goodness is moral goodness, you know, a caring goodness. And so the taste of the transcendent that I find in beauty and that I find in truth ultimately leads back to this, you know, source of spirit in the universe, which is moral, which does care, which has this capacity to love and be loved. So I could also say that the love of God is experienced through the practice of loving God in return. You know, Blaise Pascal, the 17th century French philosopher, is known for his quote, that human things must be known to be loved, but divine things must be loved to be known. And so when I am grateful, when I pray, when I have faith, when I feel God's presence, you know, this loving source, it in a sense, my love for God opens the aperture, it opens the channel by which I can receive that love in return. You know, it's definitely a circuit. And so the practice of it, you know, is not just being loved, but also loving. And these things work together in a kind of a mystical way.
Beautiful. I think this discussion of love has a lot of dimensionality. One of the, my teacher did a lot of his sadhana in the Kashmir Shaivite tradition, which is mm-hmm. an Indian tradition that is known for combining non-dual and dualistic dimensions of being and combining them with a very specific psychophysical yoga in which the practice of love of God is seen as a process of actually transmuting the body-mind, opening the chakras. It's as if the human body-mind cannot conduct the infinite except by allowing itself to go through a transformation at the gross, subtle, and causal levels so that it can coincide with the incredible power of God. And therefore, love is a transfiguration of the body-mind. And I know that very often, for me, the intensity of love is educational. It shifts something, and I see myself in different ways. That my understanding is that we contract. We tend always to be contracting, and the way my teacher taught it to me originally, which I still find valid today, is in non-dual terms, that there's a contraction at the causal level that creates the quality of separation in its negative sense, and that that expresses itself as every kind of limitation, from dullness or a sense of alienation, a flattening, a closing of the heart, a failure of insight, a failure of courage, a failure of goodness, truth, and beauty, that is a constant tendency within the being, and that there's a moment-to-moment practice of waking up from the dream, of noticing that we're tending always to contract or to go to sleep or to numb or to deaden, and that the heart has to keep reawakening, and that that's a psychophysical process, that there's actually a shift in the way the subtle currents of the being are organized, and that that requires my participation moment to moment, that over time, consistently doing that makes me more and more capable of love, more and more in touch with and capable of feeling the love of God and of seeing God in whoever's in front of me, not just my most special relationships like my son, but everyone and everything, seeing it all as the expression of God. And that's where the non-dual ground, my capacity to recognize the other as my true self, liberates my love and feeds my capacity to love.
And so that transcendence of separation is part of what feeds and powers the practice of relational love.
Sure. Well, that's why the polarity is interdependent and complementary. You know, theists, Christians Muslims or Jews who are primarily on a theistic path, the good news is that they can discover, you know, all the incredible transcendent ground of the non-dual side, and that they can allow their hearts to be filled with the spiritual experience of non-dual oneness in all its, you know, all as that path leads to. Likewise, those who are primarily on a non-dual path can now be liberated into this whole new domain of spiritual experience. I think these deep forms of spiritual experience, you know, non-dual oneness and, you know, the love of the Creator, that nothing can cause us to grow more thoroughly and more completely than these spiritual experiences. That's another part of the book I didn't get a chance to talk about, which is spiritual experience raises consciousness and actually lends itself to a kind of a level for gently persuading the evolution of consciousness and beginning to address so many of the world's problems, which are really problems of consciousness. So the more skilled we become at, you know, giving people spiritual experience or creating the conditions under which spiritual experience can emerge within them, then I think we will have a powerful new method. It could be as powerful as scientific medicine in terms of improving the human condition. If we had a method for raising consciousness through spiritual experience, I think we'd be able to grow our way out of the crisis you describe.
Well, Steve, I have a whole bunch of questions I want to keep going back and forth with you and points and nuances I'd like to raise, but we're at the point in the dialogue where it's time to invite questions. So I want to invite everyone there. If you're listening on the phone, press star 2 if you'd like to raise your hand. Or if you're listening on the webcast, type in your question into the window. And then first, I'd like to make sure that everybody knows how to find out more about Steve's work. You can buy his new book, The Presence of the Infinite, The Spiritual Experience of Beauty, Truth, and Goodness, at bookstores all over the place, including the omnipresent Amazon. And you can read excerpts on stevemcintosh.com, stevemcintosh.com. And while you're there, you can watch a high-quality video of Steve's book presentation with sophisticated questions from the audience. This was done in Boulder. He'll also be offering a workshop later this year in 2016 together with Jeff Salzman in Boulder, The Integral Escalator. And you can learn more about that at integralescalator.com. Also very exciting is the work of the Institute for Cultural Evolution, where Steve serves as president. There's a Beyond Awakening dialogue that I did with Steve on this. In a few days, I'll be sending out a blog where I'll say something about this dialogue, and I'll include a link to the dialogue we did in that, as well as the Institute for Cultural Evolution itself. It's an integral political think tank working on difficult issues such as hyperpartisan polarization. They've convened conversations about the future right and the future left, seeing both of them as necessary. Each aspect of every enduring polarity needs to evolve, and trying to help that happen. I'm on the left, so I participate on that side of things, and there's a dialogue on their website that I participated in about that. They just received a major grant. You can follow up there at culturalevolution.org. So please remember those three URLs, stevemcintosh.com, culturalevolution.org, and integralescalator.com. I also want to make sure you're aware of what I do. My work is dedicated to human transformation on all scales, focusing on both the inner and the outer work. I guide students from all over the world in deep integral synthesis of inner and outer work each year, and I'll be announcing my 2016 programs in January. In the meantime, you can find a rich body of articles, blog posts, audios, videos, events, and more, and connect with my mailing list at terrypatten.com, terrypatten.com. 2016 will be a big year for my work. I'll have a book coming out at the end of the year, and there will be opportunities to participate in person at the Kripalu Center in
Massachusetts at Esalen in California. Kripalu's in March, Esalen's in July, and also there will be other things, including Peru and Mexico, so please stay tuned. Okay, let's take a look at the questions. Remember, star 2 to raise your hand on the phone, or to just type in your question if you're listening online. Okay. Well, let's go directly to a live question. Someone who's thought long and hard and deep about these, someone I know, Tom Bugsty, has raised his hand. Welcome to the conversation, Tom. Well, let's see. Are you? Yeah, there. You're unmuted. Hi, Tom. Hello? Well,
are you hearing me?
Now we're hearing you.
Oh, good. Well, I've got the phone figured out anyway. So I was appreciating the conversation you were having, and I was thinking of it in a way that breaks us down into three different components that helps explain some of this in more practical terms for me. That I'm putting in a book on transforming the world that I'm writing now that's basically aligned with material reality, quantum reality, and then the empty potential of everything, which then gives us three different levels of existence we live in. We live in a mortal level on the material realm where we come and go in the impermanence of things, and in the quantum realm we're immortal. Because the information that that we're creating and working with the universe with persists after us. So we're part of that evolutionary scheme on a larger level than just our own evolution. And then finally, we're part of the eternal existence of the non-dual, which is the source and the potential of everything. And so I was thinking for your question, Terry, that it seemed to me that love is what links us from that mortal realm into the immortal realm and is the driver for all of evolution, in a sense, where we have to get beyond ourselves to connect with another or with something else to create a higher level of oneness from our separateness. And maybe I'll just stop there and just see if that makes sense to you or not.
Is that question primarily directed at Steve or at me or to me?
Both of you, because both of you are really experts at this.
Okay. Steve, you want to respond?
Sure. I mean, theologically speaking, I'm not sure, you know, what to make of your description. I mean, I'm sure it's true at some level, but again, as I'm one of the things I'm doing in this book and in this period of my work is to try to illuminate and bring the theistic side into evolutionary spirituality and show how it's a necessary a part of evolutionary spirituality that we can develop further than it's currently, you know, developed within the cultural agreement structures that we have. And so that goes back to ultimate reality's self-awareness. In other words, for love to be real at the ultimate level, somebody has to be home, right? It's not necessarily an anthropomorphic conception of just a being among other beings, but that the necessary being, which is the source of all being, is not just being, but it's also consciousness and bliss. You know, that consciousness, self-awareness, intentionality, creativity, and the ability to love and be loved, these are characteristics of ultimate reality, which are directly experiential, right, beyond any anthropomorphic, you know, contraction, as Terry put it. And so, you know, I guess my comment would be, was I'd like to see more emphasis on that in your schema so that the non-dual oneness, somebody can be home at that level as well.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that this appreciation for the transformation of dynamism by our recognition of the deeper oneness that underlies all conditional experience is, you know, in a sense, the place where each of these polarities crosses over to the other at its depth is the mystery itself. It's the place where the very, very truth of non-duality is, the singularity at the source of the universe 13.8 billion years ago was the source of all the complex relationality and incarnate diversity of the whole universe, and yet at the very core of love is a dissolution of all boundaries into a non-dual realization. The greatest loving mystics of the Christian tradition often described a non-dual realization as their pinnacle experience. And it seems to me the ways that we cross over from one to the other are in a mystery that's beyond. It's important that we do this philosophy. I don't mean to poo-poo the richness and rigor of this discussion, but I do think that this place of the mystery transfiguring every articulation, every perspective into its apparent opposite is so rich and at the center of what we're discussing. That's what comes forward for me to add. Before I go on to another question, there's something that I wanted to bring to you that I think is really worthwhile, which is, you know, in practical terms, you're claiming that evolutionary spirituality will be able to provide a spiritual leadership that will enter mainstream culture and evolve it. Given the current state of our cultural conversations and the many different stucknesses, you know, like the gridlock between red and blue states and between atheistic modernism and the spirit, you know, transrational spirituality and its expressions in the progressive spiritual world. How exactly could that happen? Where do you see the leverage points for evolutionary spirituality to lead the evolution of culture?
I see it primarily in its the new level at which it understands what the beautiful, the true, and the good are. You know, as I mentioned, I think evolutionary spirituality might also be called beauty, truth, and goodness spirituality. And while every stage has its beauty, truth, and goodness, every one of these stages of consciousness and culture, including its forms of spirituality, can be understood as like an octave of what's beautiful, true, and good. And so we've got a new octave now, and one that's transcendent and inclusive. So I think a huge leverage point is by helping people appreciate that what they find in the world to be beautiful, true, and good, that these are forms of spiritual energy, forms of spiritual experience that we can put to use. You know, we can actually bring to bear upon the problems of evolution and the problems of our world, the opportunities for self-actualization that we each possess, that these forms of spiritual energy, understood at the evolutionary level, you know, more broadly and deeply than ever before, that these lend themselves to a method. You know, I think that we will demonstrate the power of evolutionary spirituality as we bring to bear the philosophical understanding of spiritual energy itself as understood through the lens of the beautiful, the true, and the good, and how these forms of spiritual experience are literally experiences of pure being as it's refracted within this realm of becoming. I mean, a more sophisticated understanding of spiritual experience and a better inclusion of what's come before. You know, the re-inclusion of the religious heritage of Western civilization has got to make evolutionary spirituality more agreeable to a wider audience than progressive spirituality has been able to achieve.
Well, that sounds good in principle, and I don't disagree with it. As you know, I participated in a debate at the last Integral Theory Conference, the proposition under consideration being integral culture must abandon its spirituality to have mainstream impact. And,
right, right.
The hostility to spiritual experience of all kinds in many corners of academia, business, and various mainstream institutions was highlighted there. Both of us agree that spirituality is essential, but there is a resistance to it having influence. You know, how can an evolutionary spirituality participate in the actual nitty-gritty of transforming this cultural resistance to the very source of the inspiration and insight and passion and care that can transform and evolve a culture?
Well, there's about, you know, 10 answers to that question, but I mean, that all kind of are different facets of the diamond, so that's a very important question. But let me take a stab at least one of them. And that is this recognition of the dialectical pattern, you know, that I mentioned, which can be simplified as thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, right? So we have the thesis of the mainstream, right, modernity, you know, American society as represented by the establishment. And then we have a very visible and clear antithesis, right, a pushing off against the rejection of modernity, its values, its pathologies, its crimes, right? The way forward for progressive culture is to kind of become the antithesis of the mainstream establishment, right? That began in the 60s, but it's not just simply, you know, the kind of the hippie youth movement. It's matured into a counterculture, which has its own form of establishment, its own power base, right, within certain forms of critical academia, certainly within, you know, the progressive alternative milieu, within parts of the entertainment establishment. I mean, you know, postmodernism is its own significant cultural structure, even though it's only about 20% of the demographic of the United States. But one of the ways that all the diverse forms of postmodern culture are pulled together as a coherent worldview is that there's a general and strong agreement about the abundant pathologies of modernity, right? So the antithesis is clear, the thesis and antithesis, the dialectical tension between these two major forms of culture in American society. I mean, there are other forms as well, but these are the two that we're talking about in this context, that they're pointing to the opportunity for a synthesis. Right, the synthesis of the evolutionary integral view and its spirituality is way more synthetic than the kind of understandably antithetical stance of progressive spirituality. Right, it's permanently alternative, and that in a sense makes it less agreeable to the mainstream because, you know, the thesis and antithesis have tension between each other. So we're transcending the antithesis. You know, Hegel, you know, kind of who is probably most famous for this idea of the thesis, antithesis, synthesis dialectic, never really even used those terms. He phrased the dialectic in terms of affirmation, negation, and then negation of the negation. So the negation of the negation doesn't involve a complete invalidation or erasure of the original negation, but it does bring back some of the original affirmation. It has to prune away certain elements of the first negation so that the negation of the negation, if you'll allow me to make this philosophical argument, can emerge, right? So culturally, at the level of feeling, at the level of identity, at the level of loyalty, where people can think fast and know what's going on even without having to analyze it philosophically, they can feel the difference between the antithesis and the synthesis. So the synthesis of evolutionary spirituality is in a sense partially negating the limitations of progressive spirituality. We're pushing off against the New Age. We're saying we're sick of this. It's not good enough. It's not true enough. And we're claiming a higher truth that we think, that I think, that I argue has power, you know, whether this comes about in the next 5 years or in the next 50 years. You know, progressive spirituality and postmodernism itself is not the end of history, right? Something more is needed. And integral spirituality does this by, you know, in a sense, without regressing to modernism or traditionalism, but making a distinct dialectical break with the counterculture in ways that isn't so much about rejecting modernity and being pissed off about its crimes, but also appreciating that there's very important accomplishments, and we're standing on the shoulders of those accomplishments, and better appreciating, you know, the heritage of Western civilization, both spiritually, culturally, and even politically, is part of the project of this integral emergence.
Well, how does the reintegration of theism advance that? It's not immediately intuitively obvious, I think, to most people.
Well, I think there's a powerful spiritual experience to be had with the love of God that itself can raise consciousness. I mean, you know, there are people, there are modernists, you know, both atheistic and ambivalent about spirituality, for whom any kind of spiritual talk is going to be rejected, right? We're not talking about any kind of emergence or transformative step forward can never bring along everyone. But there are a major segment of American society who describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. And these are not just people who are identified with progressive spirituality. It's a much broader demographic, including the majority of the millennials, the majority of America's youth. While they're not going to go for religious spirituality, you know, they're clearly not embracing progressive spirituality in any kind of large numbers at this point. In fact, at this time in history, progressive spirituality is shrinking for the most part. So the fact that there's hunger for some new kind of spirituality, or a better, truer, more beautiful kind of spirituality, is evident. I mean, you can see it in the demographic polls, although, you know, I don't want to put too much weight on that evidentiarily, but I do want to make the argument that that deep down, spiritual experience and some kind of spiritual path is an existential need. You know, self-actualization is an existential need of every human. And I would argue that there's no self-actualization without some kind of spiritual path. And so the fact that there's this large segment of American society for who are hungry for spirituality, for they haven't found a form of spirituality, neither religious nor progressive, that they can identify with, evolutionary spirituality provides a more agreeable form of spiritual teaching and practice, not only because it integrates theism, but also because it better integrates science on its own terms, you know, through the spiritual teachings of evolution. You know, I think it's got tremendous potential, you know, but again, you know, like every form of emergence, at the very beginning, it's difficult to tell the something more from the something less. You know, inevitably, authentic evolutionary emergence means something more comes from something less. But here at the very infancy, the very beginning of this emergence of evolutionary spirituality, it's hard to point to big pieces of evidence that say, oh, yeah, this is going to be the next big thing. But somebody has to pioneer it. You and I have to pioneer it, and others who are joining us in this evolutionary spiritual culture in its, you know, nascent beginning. You know, there's a certain degree of faith that the spiritual experience that we've had that has enlivened us, that's filling our hearts, that can be used by others and can bring about the spiritual renaissance that we really need at this time.
Well, I share that sentiment, but I'd like to kind of mention again as a bookmark for further conversation later, rather than inviting
sure.
you to respond to it, and then I want to move on to another question. But I see a mainstreaming of spirituality explicitly in terms of non-duality, in terms of the mainstreaming of mindfulness, Sam Harris's synthesis, which is strictly non-dual. You know, these things are attracting a lot of people and doing something to dent the stigma against spirituality, and not in the terms you're describing. I see more resistance to a theistic spirituality than to a non-dual spirituality among modernists. So let's put that in as a bookmark, just in terms of the cultural project.
Sure.
I'd like to ask you more about how this integrates with the Institute for Cultural Evolution, but there are some really great questions, more than we're going to be able to get to. Let me grab... Here's a rather challenging one, but it'll be fun. It'll liven up our conversation. The Urantia book is the most preposterous, metaphysical bunch of silliness I've ever seen, and yet supposedly it's a great source of inspiration to your spirituality. How are you not in a position like those of Mormons trying to defend ridiculous ideas?
Right. Well, I've read the Urantia book, but I'm not an advocate of it. I don't identify myself as a, you know, Urantia book religionist. So I'm not sure where that question is coming from. I think that the Urantia book is, has like many forms of spiritual teaching, there are, you know, silly mythic elements, stuff that could be discarded. But there's also some, you know, interesting truths in there. I think it's way more intellectually sophisticated than the Book of Mormon. But again, I'm not carrying that cross. I'm not advocating that book. And, you know, I don't need to defend against it.
Okay, very good. Among the many great questions here is one that I think is particularly juicy. Maybe we can go a little over time. I feel like we're in the midst of a lot of very rich stuff. James says that it seems like this is all circling around personality, but neither of you have used that word. For the most part, non-dual modalities don't accommodate personality in spiritual terms. So how does an evolutionary approach include personality?
Wow. Well, I could definitely say that this idea of personality is a deep and rich, you know, concept unto itself. You know, that again, we could have an entire dialogue on the meaning, the deeper spiritual meanings of personality. And I think it's also, when we talk about personality in ultimate reality, it's very important that there be careful distinctions between this concept of God as person that is anthropocentric, right? Something that we've taken great pains to transcend. You know, the idea of a being, a capricious being among other beings who's somehow responsible for creating the universe. You know, that picture of God has been used as a straw man by those who want to attack mythic or for religious spirituality, again, for understandable reasons. But the idea that what really is the heart of our own spiritual being has to do with being persons, you know, that is, if according to, you know, Advaita Vedanta, if we are it, if we're part of the whole, if we're an unseparated part of the whole, and we're personal, you know, that we can love and be loved as individuals, that we have the personal powers of intention and, you know, a loving heart, these are things which are personal. So the idea that ultimate reality can't be less than personal while not being a person, while not being anthropocentric, while not being just a being among other beings, but being the necessary being, which is being itself, which is not just the perfection of being or the perfection of truth, but also the perfection of this thing, this spiritually foundational thing we call personality, that clearly the ultimate partakes of this personality in a way that transcends our finite concept of it, but still retains, you know, this loving heart, this intentionality, this will, this creativity, as I'm arguing, you know, that God can't be anything less than personal. And so, again, the getting into the teasing apart the philosophical definitions of what personality really entails and how it could exist at an ultimate level, you know, that's an interesting philosophical question, but beyond something that I could answer in a short answer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are so many rich questions. I want to apologize to listeners who have asked many of them that won't get asked. But let me bring forward one. Alexandra in Seattle kind of asks you to extend your discussion of the dialectic of progress. She asks if progressive spirituality pushed off from and negated modernity and evolutionary integral spirituality is the negation of the negation, what might we imagine would follow evolutionary spirituality? A new affirmation without a force of negation, or a new negation of the negation? How do the waves of evolution continue to unfold?
Well, I love that question. I get asked it a lot, and I give an answer to it in the video of my Boulder talk, so I can point people there, but I can also take a stab at it now. I think that in this dialectical process of development, that when a new stage or a new step emerges, you know, it has a season of synthesis where it's getting its primary work done. You know, the opportunities for progress are you know, abundant, but eventually, as it succeeds and becomes more established, in part of the natural process of evolutionary development, every stage kind of decays into a more static thesis of itself, which then calls forth the opportunity to go farther through a new dialectical step, you know, a new transcendent step. And so because this evolutionary or integral worldview and its spirituality is just in its beginning, as I mentioned, it hasn't achieved the success necessary that will bring about its inevitable shadow or pathologies. I mean, we can speculate, and I will, but I just want to say that at this point it's speculation, because until we get the job done of achieving the evolutionary progress that's the potential, we're not going to see, you know, where the shadows are cast. But in my 2007 book, In Integral Consciousness, I talk about both a critique of every one of the stages, including a critique of the integral stage, and I speculate and kind of try to explore this idea of post-integral, you know, for lack of a better term. And the major thinker who I think we could point to as having elements of a kind of a proto-post-integral perspective would be the German philosopher Martin Heidegger, right, who in a sense critiqued all of philosophy, all of Western philosophy since Plato, as being, in a sense, creating a fog of conceptuality, right, that obscuring our ability to make unmediated contact with pure being. Because ever since Plato, you know, ever since all the steps of Western philosophy have been exceedingly conceptual, and so we're kind of tiling over our ability to experience pure being through these concepts. And so Heidegger's project was to try to eliminate the conceptual mediation that philosophy kind of steps into, and try to get at being itself, try to experience what is being in an unmediated way. I mean, obviously, I can't summarize Heidegger here in a two-minute answer, but I can point to the transcendence of conceptual philosophy, you know, altogether, or at least a kind of negation of its conceptuality in a way that can bring us back to being as it is in itself, you know, even though that is just mediated through human consciousness, which can, you know, never really get at a thing as it is in itself, at least some argue. I would say that the spiritual experience of ultimate reality, we can experience the thing itself, but, you know, that's its own can of worms philosophically. I could just say that read Heidegger if you want to get a sense of what post-integral philosophy or spirituality might be.
If you've got a really high capacity for using abstraction to dissolve abstraction.
Right, it's a great sleep aid.
Well, Steve, we're getting here to the end of the our time. I want to ask you a question. One of our listeners in Cincinnati asked if you'd repeat that insight from Houston Smith, the one about a great truth, the opposite of
right.
a great truth.
Right, right. And I'm sure Houston Smith has said it in many places, but his dialogue in this book, he has a fabulous book published by SUNY in the late 80s, where Houston Smith and David Ray Griffin are in dialogue about theism and non-duality, and I highly recommend the book, Postmodern Theology, and I can't remember the title, but in there he says that the opposite of a small truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a great truth is an equal and opposite truth. And I think that's especially the case when it comes to spirituality. I mean, it's not a thesis of relativism. It's just a recognition that in the finite, ultimacy is experienced in a way that it's refracted. It's, you know, these polarities, this motif of being and becoming conditions our experience, and it even conditions our experience of spirit. And so understanding that this being and becoming motif is a fractally part of almost every spiritual experience we can have helps us appreciate that when we come upon a great truth that raises our consciousness, that opens our heart, that causes spiritual growth, that we can often find an equal and opposite truth, which is in an interdependent relationship. And that's one of the big breakthroughs of evolutionary spirituality.
Well, Steve, this is a conversation that is going to continue. I'm so happy because of our friendship, and you've been a guest here a couple times before, and I'm sure we'll have other opportunities to take this forward in public forums. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. I want you to know that before I tell you what's coming up next, if you're turned on by what Steve has had to say, get his new book, The Presence of the Infinite, and remember his three URLs, stevemackintosh.com, culturalevolution.org, and integralescalator.com. And if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. My next dialogue will be in early January with
Stephen Jenkinson, the author of Die Wise, a very profound guy who's midwifed thousands of people through the death process and has remarkable insights about what it is to go beyond our denial of death and how transformative that can be in our psyches. Thanks so much for joining Steve and me today. And thank you, Steve. This has been, as always, a total blast.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you for your wisdom and for this opportunity to dialogue together.
Okay. Well, goodbye, everybody.
All right.